Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents If Sons, Then Heirs, a novel by Lorraine Carey, read by Zuleika Wundler. For you have not received a spirit of slavery, leading to fear again, but you have received a spirit of adoption as sons, and of sons, then heirs. Romans, chapter 8, verse 15 to 17. If we know that the past also lies in the present, we understand that we are able to change the past by transforming the present. Thich Nhat Hanh, Our Appointment with Life. Chapter 1. Joelle Thompson nosed her sedan into the narrow Philadelphia street. She had directions on the seat next to her, and also the letter. In her mind, a voice from the past, her grandmother's, shouted, "We home," which was ridiculous since she'd never been on the street or even in this section of the city before. Outside her nosy mind, rows of identical two-story brick houses squatted beside Cobbs Creek Park, muffled by heavy fog and a cold, early spring, early Sunday morning quiet. She had to drive cautiously. No more than 4 or 5 inches separated her driver's side from the curb or her passenger side from the parked cars, whose owners had carefully folded in their side-view mirrors. She slowed nearly to a stop when she saw house numbers that matched the return address on the letter. They were gold and white, painted onto a glossy black brick face. Prim white sills and lintels, like shirt cuffs, shone through the drizzle, and white lines traced the mortar. When she'd left her house, Joelle had told her husband she might, depending on the way things looked, knock on the door. Now, presented with the reality of this shiny black cookie jar of a building on the misty working-class West Philadelphia street, she doubted she'd have the courage. In front of the house grew a large sycamore that had buckled the sidewalk. At the level of the second floor, mottled limbs reached out over the street and twinkled with tiny white Christmas lights. An extension cord connected them to the second floor window. She couldn't quite see, but it looked as if they'd drilled a hole in the storm window trim for the cord, so as not to have to leave the window open. Joelle smiled to herself. Clever. She imagined that the lights made the little street feel inviting at night. A parking space under the tree beckoned, but it seemed too close and obvious, so she let her car roll forward one car length to the stop sign. Some bright, false part of herself congratulated her on the trip. There. Done. Now I can go home. Instead, she sat motionless at the stop sign. She did not even notice the large red pickup truck behind her until the driver touched his horn. In her rearview mirror, she could see a man of about 30 who seemed to fill the cab. He indicated the parking space under the tree, which he could not maneuver into with her car in the way. The truck would have to swing out very wide. Joelle crossed the intersection, put her foot onto the brake, and checked her rearview mirror again. The big ochre-colored man was unfolding himself in the cab of the truck and stepping into the street. She shifted in her seat to see him better. He looked familiar. The letter to her was folded in its envelope on the front seat. She read its block capital letters so often in the past week, she almost knew it by heart. "Dear Miss Joelle Thompson, I am looking for my mother, formerly Joelle Needham, the daughter of Bobo Needham, originally from the town of Gunnerson in Beaufort County, South Carolina. Please let me know if you are that lady. We lived in New York, in Harlem, I think, until I was about 7. Then I was sent to my grandfather Bobo Needham and his stepmother Selma Needham in South Carolina, who also raised him. Now I'm 30 years old. I'm doing well. I am a contractor now, and just received my first contract with the city of Philadelphia. I said that I wished I could tell you, and my girlfriend suggested that I write this, and she would try to find an address for me to send it to. I live with my girlfriend and her son. He is about the age I was when I was separated from my mother. That's another reason I'm writing. Watching him grow has made me think about you. I hope that you will agree to meet. If you are not the right person, please let me know. This could just be one meeting, if you like. It doesn't have to be more. Here's my information for home or work. Email is best, or cell. Sincerely, Alonzo Rain.
That was Lonnie in the truck behind Joelle. She knew it.
Joelle remembered her son's deep-set, coffee-black-brown eyes, like her grandfather's. A big gap between his front teeth came from her grandfather, too. When Joelle had allowed herself to think of Lonnie as a man, she fitted his 7-year-old face into the image in her head of her grandfather King's old sepia-tone photo. Nana Selma had had a mantel built, sans fireplace, just to make a proper display, like an altar, for that photograph. It had been taken by a black photographer in Colombia, whom Selma referred to as famous. Later, when Joelle learned about African ancestor worship, she thought of that photo. Surely the hulking farmer in his white shirt and stiff collar had seemed to live with them. Selma spoke to him as she walked by. She asked questions of him in passing and seemed to receive answers. King had been a big, pale man burned bronze by the sun. His head and neck and shoulders filled the frame. The wide mouth and jaw were set, as if against the coming misfortune. His deep-set eyes looked straight and unsmilingly from under dark, arched brows into the small room that his father had built and he had improved. Joelle had been afraid of those eyes and their judgment. Now, she was seemingly afraid of her son's. His letter had been perfectly cordial, but, surely, he had to remember what she had done, just as she remembered and could never forget, starting with the train. Joelle had put him on that southbound train and convinced herself that he'd be riding into a new, wholesome boyhood.
He's much better off.
Recalling how far she'd sunk back then, she'd repeated it to herself through the years. Much better off. And until this moment, she'd mostly been able to keep herself from thinking about how very deeply he might hate her. She stopped the car and watched him in the mirror. It looked as if he were even taller than her father, big and hulking like him, with a walk that rolled his shoulders side to side. On his head, he wore a skull cap, stretched over thick dreadlocks that reminded her of how unruly his hair had been when he was a boy. He unloaded from the back of the truck 2 boxes, walked them to the black and white house, and rang the bell. A young woman peeked her head out into the drizzle. Slim, brown, animated, she waved her hands even as he shook his head no. She had big hair, too, twists or some similar style that poked out in all directions. She stepped onto the stoop and clearly strained to pick up 1 box and take it inside. There were open boxes, filled with objects Joelle could not identify, except to see that the heavy contents seemed to slide when the young woman tried to pick up the top one. He called to her. Joelle saw his raised hand make a dismissing movement, which the young woman ignored. Instead, she called into the house. A boy of about 7 erupted from the doorway, danced a little moonwalk on the top step, then held the door for her, hands and legs moving in place. With that, she bent deep and hoisted and then carried first 1 box, then the other. Once the woman finished, the boy banged the door closed and ran, shouting into the quiet street. Lonnie. Joelle called him that in her mind, pointed to the truck bed, and spoke to the boy. It looked as if he was directing him to carry something else into the house. The boy climbed up onto the bumper and reached in at the same time that Lonnie pulled out another box. Instead of grabbing his own parcel, however, the child vaulted onto Lonnie's back, laughing. Lonnie bent forward slightly to accommodate him, said something to him sideways, then stopped in the middle of the street to regard Joel's car and the woman inside it. Watching him, he squinted pointedly through the dim drizzle light at the rearview mirror and opened his big hands in an impatient gesture that communicated, "What are you looking at?" to Joelle. Flushed and embarrassed, Joelle took off too fast down the one-way street. The next intersecting street went the wrong way to aim her back toward the expressway. 1 block more took her to a street that was stupid with police barrier around construction. Although she was turned around now and confused,
Joelle decided, superstitiously, that her way home was blocked because she was supposed to drive back to Lonnie's house and introduce herself. Besides, she wanted to see him close up. She wanted to feel again the totally undeserved surge of pride that had filled her as she watched him, with his rolling gait and strength and his relationships, whatever they were, with the young woman with hair as big and wild as his own and the boy who whooped with glee and jumped onto his back. She wondered if he still had his great-grandfather's gap-toothed smile. How could such a person have burst, full-grown, into her life? It was a strange feeling. The driver of the champagne-colored Lexus on the next block was studying him, and so intently that when Alonzo Freeman Rain looked up and squinted into her rearview mirror, it was as if the driver didn't register the challenge, but only continued to observe. Rain stared at her hard. At first, he thought she was a case of early morning road rage, pissed off because he urged her forward to let him into the parking space in front of the house. She had not seemed offended. No visible huffing and puffing, no flip of the finger. From what he could see at this distance, she appeared simply to have been watching, head to the side. Was he imagining her smiling? As if he were a movie. It crossed Rain's mind that the woman in the car might be his mother responding to the letter he just sent 3 weeks before. His mother had smiled that day on the train when she left. A memory that clicked into his brain like the sound of an accident. Not the image of her so much as the fact of the smile. Now it came back to him. And had Khalil not hopped onto his back, Rain would have walked toward her to get a better view or, if he didn't like what he saw, to move her along. From a distance, the driver looked white. Did his mother? Really? For years, he'd assumed that he'd know her when he saw her, but now he knew that he couldn't. He could only conjure bits of feelings about her or moments. He remembered the train, holding on to the fine material of her skirt, and then letting go. He remembered that she smiled at him with such love that in the years after, he could never believe the things his grandfather said about her. And he remembered the loss of her that seared him to his bowels. Just the smallest incitement could ignite the rage that had made him want to burn things. Burn houses, burn his own house, with himself in it even, in hopes that she'd come, see, smell, hear his cries, and finally, finally, love him. In his adolescence, Rain had taken up boxing. His grandfather Bobo suggested it, having correctly gauged the depth of the boy's sullenness. And, indeed, Rain came to life in the Philadelphia gym of a man named Magic, who encouraged him and other young men to feed their hungers with closed fists. Rain's big, long arms knocked boys down. He would let a boy come at him with a hard chin, lean out and away from his fists, and then he'd come in close and hard with a few uppercuts that the opponent couldn't have expected. Then he'd rear back, faint a little, all this fast, so fast that his mind knew it in the body only, and couldn't see it, then rock back on the heels and check for the other guy's fear, see it, hold it in mind, then plant his feet, find the opened millisecond, and throw in the hardest punch his opponent had ever taken. Each time, it was to be a better punch than ever before. The punch he trained for with the heaviest heavy bag Magic had, going at it again and again, past exhaustion, running harder and longer than the other boys, bringing all of it into his shoulder and arm, and slamming it into a young man's chin. One time, he actually sheared off a tiny bit of bone. He knocked one boy's tooth out and drove another's back into his gum, laying open part of his face, shocking him, insulting him, rearranging. One of Lily's Zen stories told about a man holding onto a branch with a tiger above him in a deep gully below. Rain usually forgot the whole story, but that image described how he'd felt through much of his adolescence, the sense he had on the train that his mother loved him so perfectly, exclusively, in a way no one else could ever know, had not been confirmed. After all, she did not come to get him that September when school began. She did not come back for him at all. But he held on anyway, because there was a tiger above and a gully beneath. Boxing helped him hold on, at least until Bobo went to prison. Then, the discipline of boxing held him over until adulthood. It sopped up some of the anger that used to slosh in his sunny days and threatened to drown him in plain sight of the whole wide world. By the time Lonnie reached manhood, his own rage was not inevitably the final word, though great quantities of it had been compacted and stored in basement catacombs, not dead, but buried alive, like the Irishman he'd heard about who contracted cholera in the 19th century Philadelphia. They'd gone into comas and been buried, only to wake up underground. Sometimes he felt it stir with Lily. It was not her fault, but since he'd moved into her house, she could get in there where the monster lived. "There's a guy came to the hospital to see this little boy," she told him, "and instead of asking the kid how he feels, he just roars at him. Roar!
That's what you should do for Khalil. He'd love that."
"Nah, that's what I'ma do to you when you get like that, because can't nobody talk to you." Roar, it was their shorthand. He'd want to rip the head off something alive, but would go outdoors instead and trot along Cobb's Creek. You could do a lot of miles on Cobb's Creek. He'd wear himself out and come home spent. No need to roar. Lily had suggested, the year before, that he write his mother. At first it seemed to come out of nowhere, and it annoyed him. She told them that if he wrote the letter, she'd help him find an address. He told her that he was not trying to dredge anything up. "When you're ready," she'd said. He hadn't liked the word, ready. The image of his mother in Rain's mind was of a flawless 20-year-old beauty with dark, shiny hair, shining eyes, perfectly bowed red lips, and an expression of perfect contentment. It was from a photo she'd taken and sent to Selma when they lived in New York. The caption, written in black ink, said, "To Nana Selma, from your rascal in New York, who won't give up." Rain had no personal memory strong enough to trump that stunning picture, which remained as sharp and glossy in his mind as it had in the bottom drawer where his grandfather Bobo kept it out of sight. When he'd first found it at age 12, Rain had just about lost the ability to see her face clearly in his mind. The image underneath Bobo's old socks, which Rain had gone to pilfer, appeared so beautiful that he burst into tears, right there in his grandfather's dusty old bedroom in Selma's otherwise fastidious little farmhouse. Rain vowed that that would be the last time he cried for her. Now the image stayed submerged, mostly down at the bottom of his brainstem, quite perfect, engaged in a vague personal tragedy, almost separate from himself. His memories of his mother had been surfacing since the letter, which he wrote the night after Khalil, squatting over a pile of junk, just like this one, had ventured to call him Dad. On this raw Sunday morning, as he prepared to drive to Gunnison, South Carolina, the creamy Lexus purred away and did not come back. Rain decided that the Sunday morning white lady was probably a real estate agent, hoping that the latest foreclosure might be worth more than $3.85. Halfway through her 2-year nursing program, Lily had dropped behind her monthly payments, with only a few years to go to finish off her mother's mortgage. It was why he'd moved in with her. Who knew that 6 months into it, Khalil, who'd been so cool for a year, would squat among the found objects, or found lost, as Lily had scrawled on the back brick wall, and address him, secretly, with penetrating intimacy, as Dad, with love that made him want to run. But after the car drove away and did not circle back, Rain dismissed the moment, finished unpacking the truck, and went inside quickly to lay out the stuff, say goodbye, and get on the road to his Nana Selma's. He could almost hear her calling, "Yoo-hoo," as he did.
"Yoo-hoo, you coming home or what?"
Chapter 2. It was already past 7. Lily was filling the cooler with lunch, dinner, and snacks. She was very careful and very intentional about food. As a nursing student and the daughter of a diabetic Filipina mother and an alcoholic black father, She said she had no choice. She said it regularly as a matter of faith, and Rain never failed to laugh and counter.
Oh, you had some choices there, baby. You had choices.
To tease her, Rain said that he was hoping to grab fast food on the drive. She'd already put a 12-pack of water bottles and his construction thermos filled with fresh coffee next to his duffel bag by the vestibule. She peeled his favorite navel oranges, torn them into sections, and put them into a plastic container for him to eat right away. The house smelled of coffee and oranges, which made him want to sit down in the kitchen and read the paper, as he had when they'd first fallen in love and she'd spent the night at his apartment. No morning now was that relaxed. Every day was a push as Lily powered through a 2-year post-grad nursing program at Jefferson University. While she had the help, she'd once said before apologizing, but that's how it was. He'd co-signed the educational loan, and he was paying the mortgage on the little house her parents had left her. At first, Rain and Lily said that living together would be like a family, which each of them missed. Hers having died young, his in prison, down south, gone. But, in fact, the easygoing lovers made for watchful, even tense, cohabitants. Everything was hard. Nursing school was hard. Starting the construction business was hard. Sharing the space and their lives tentatively, and figuring out to handle the boy together, all of it kept them on edge. And Rain sensed that she was pushing him to be other than he was. Only Lily's son, Khalil, made the decision to commit. Full stop. Lily bent over the cooler as Rain walked the boxes through the house to the backyard, making sure not to let them weep dust along the way. The thin floorboards vibrated. The countertop was crowded with food, and it irritated him that she worked so hard. He really would have been just as happy with fast food.
"Everything all right?" she asked, head down.
"Yeah, I told you that I had to go make sure they'd locked up the little job downtown properly, didn't I?"
Lily flashed him a tight grin and shrug. He'd left at 5 a.m. after she'd obliged him with perfunctory early morning sex. He'd said something, sure, but she couldn't remember what. He told her how he'd driven to his shop in North Philly to collect the boxes quickly at 5:20 a.m. and switch trucks. Then, when he drove by the downtown construction job whose building permit was still pending, he saw that the demo crew he'd hired had lost the padlock on the construction door and tied it with an old rope. He thought about simply nailing the place shut, but the neighbors there were suspicious. Instead, he drove back to the shop in North Philly for a new padlock, left the new key on his desk with a note, and drove back downtown to secure the building before leaving town for 5 days.
"So now it's 7, and I should be, like, halfway through Maryland."
"Khalil would have been happy with one box," Lily said as Rain stomped through with the last of the heavy parcels. Everything in them was made of metal and brick, concrete and wood.
There were faucets with glass handles, cut in the shapes of long crystals, claw feet without their table legs, a large, rusty knocker forged in the shape of a wolf's head.
"Spring vacation is just for the week."
"You know what I really want?"
Rain stopped and shifted the box under his arm. Lily's glasses were on, and her thick, wild hair was pulled back and tied in a scarf, as always when she cooked. The warm kitchen smelled of cornbread. There was as close to home as he could imagine creating, but he did not trust contentment. Neither, Lily admitted, did she.
"What do you really want?" she asked.
She came toward him, pulled the step stool from the corner with her foot, stepped up, and kissed him deeply. A desire flared up and caught them off guard. Careful, as Lily usually was when Khalil was nearby, Rain held her to him with his free arm. She smelled like oranges in early morning.
"I must have been too fast this morning."
"I was sleepy."
"Now you're awake?"
"It's 7 o'clock.
"Just a quickie."
Lily surprised him by looking slyly from him to the kitchen door, to the yard, and back again.
"Give him that box."
Then she scampered upstairs. When Rain stepped into the backyard, a chilly mist carried the familiar smell of horses. From the box he was carrying, he handed Khalil what he thought was the best find of the lot, a stone-carved gargoyle about a foot and a half high. Khalil made a first inspection, running his palm over the spikes and curves and poking his finger down its throat. Rain explained that a downspout would run into a pipe in the throat to conduct rainwater, and they could make a small funnel from the house downspout through this gargoyle when they mounted it.
If your mom says yes, I'll have to angle it so that it hits the drain there by the corner of the house.
Whoa,
Khalil said. He cradled the heavy demon to his wiry body and sank down onto his haunches to inspect it, ignoring the sound that still startled Rain each time he heard it there in West Philadelphia. The whinny of a horse and the pawing of her hooves on the packed yard. Across the alley from Lily, a bizarre, quasi-legal stable maintained by a leathery urban cowboy in his 60s took up two house plots on the next street. It featured a dirty yard, alternately dusty, muddy, or frozen throughout the seasons, where one beautiful old chestnut mare sometimes came out for air or to be saddled or groomed. The horseman wore a hard brown saddleback frown and a dusty cocoa brown cowboy hat and chaps. He cha-chinged through Rite Aid and Pathmark in pointed boots with spurs. He and a dozen and a half comrades called themselves Buffalo Soldiers. They rode singly or in a movie soundtrack cantering group over the tough green and brown bank of Cobbs Creek. On Saturdays, they gave rides and dispensed history lessons and tough love to neighborhood boys. At first, Rain had leaned a ladder against the wall so that Khalil could climb up and look into the tiny corral. Soon enough, the boy began to play on the ladder, straddling one of the middle rungs and the top of the fence, or grabbing a handhold on the sill of the bay window. They began to plan the climbing wall to replace the ladder. With a perch past the second story that would command a view of the barn and the alley. The found objects from Rain's demo sites would serve as handholds and foot supports. Lily had not okayed the idea yet, so Rain had held off building, just as he'd held off stripping the black paint off the front. Until she came around, he told Khalil they could sort and design the wall, and then redesign and draw plans. When Rain brought in his boxes of found objects, he and the boy knelt together in the intimate space under the bay window overhang, discussing their attributes and possible placements. It was there that Khalil had first called Rain Dad, so quietly and tentatively that Rain could not be sure he'd heard properly. And it was in that same space now, crowded with new boxes for Khalil's inspection, where Khalil asked, as lightly and naturally as if Rain were going to the supermarket,
"Can I go?"
Rain's hand was on the storm door knob, and his mind had already traveled upstairs to where he hoped Lily was still waiting. Had he heard him?
To South Carolina?
Khalil nodded.
Yeah, it's Easter break, and I'm off of school anyway. Oh, and we can go fishing in that mermaid place where you said the sea backs up into the river?
Khalil looked up at Rain, wanting to ask again, but afraid to knock over the delicate balance of Rain's quiet, real consideration. Khalil gripped the gargoyle's head and dragged his hand over the ears and across the rough neck, as if he were petting a new family dragon.
Can I?
Khalil asked again, almost a whisper that traveled nearly 6 feet up to Rain's ears only. They talked about it that year, the fact that Khalil was just about old enough to join Rain on a trip south, how good it would be for him to have the experience of early generations, to spend time in a rural setting, to know from their own experiences that black people hadn't always lived stacked in matching boxes, and that they owned land and barns and silos, that they had rights to water from creeks and streams. Besides, speaking of that land, Rain planned to talk to Nana Selma about selling it so that he could set her up, down there or closer to him in Philadelphia, in a nice retirement facility. It was not a conversation he looked forward to having with her. Khalil would be the perfect buffer.
If it's okay with your mother, it's okay with me.
Khalil jumped right up from where he'd been squatting.
Shh, shh, shh. Yo, little man. Half a yes can still mean no. Let me ask her. You stay here. I'ma go ask her. Do not come in till I call you. Hear me?
You don't want me to go pack?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?